17 years after the American invasion, we're still talking about Afghanistan and Americans serving there in uniform, trying to get the non-Taliban parts of the country to come together into a cohesive whole. It takes everything from gunfights to quiet conversations. We'll focus on the conversations in this hour because they involve the women of Afghanistan and the American women in uniform who work to create bonds with them through FETs, female engagement teams. We meet some of these women from those teams in a book by Eileen Rivers called Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. Eileen Rivers is an editor and editorial board member at USA Today. She is herself a veteran of war reporting on Iraq and Afghanistan and herself an Army veteran, having spent time in Kuwait just after the first Gulf War. Eileen Rivers, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It sounds like your language skills got a lot of use in Kuwait in your own tour of duty.
They did. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to do what Fed teams did, which seems so much more exciting to me. But yeah, I mean, I was an Arabic linguist. That's what I was trained in the military to do. And so I went to Kuwait in pursuit of some of those missions.
Did you have combat training?
No, I didn't. So I was not a combat soldier. And at the time when I was in the military, there was no way even for like a Fed assignment for me to be anything close to a combat soldier. I was in military intelligence, so I went to basic training, just like so many other soldiers do. You get, you know, basic training on firearms. You learn some combat maneuvers, but you certainly don't learn anything even close to the level of what infantry soldiers learn. So no, I was in military intelligence.
So Eileen, help people understand, because women can serve in combat now. The first women graduated from infantry
Correct.
Basic training last year, but
yep.
the women in this
That's
book
right.
hadn't gone to that extent. Is that right?
That's right. And in fact, these were women who were on the front lines, and they were the last group of women to do so before combat fully opened to women. So in many ways, they were, just like generations of women before them, very critical to changing the military's impression of what women could do. And with these women, what's very critical is that they were on the front lines doing those combat jobs before the combat jobs were officially open to them. So they were really like the last group of women to push the Pentagon to say, okay, women are there, we see what they're doing, we see that they're capable, let's make some changes.
That really was a lot of it for the Pentagon. It sounds like that, you know, essentially women were doing the things that they were not supposed to be doing already.
Exactly. And that was at the convenience of the military. So they were, you know, joining, combat missions. They were being assigned to infantry units to go out on combat missions in teams of two or three. So they were really on the front lines, exposed to as much danger. And in some instances, because of these, you know, what we can now look back on and see were incredibly silly and very dangerous rules, they were put in more danger in some instances.
Oh, because they couldn't defend themselves, or just put in situations of danger where they weren't in a position to fight their way out?
Well, not because they couldn't defend themselves. I mean, in part, you're kind of right. Like, they were put out there, at least the first group of women, Team Lioness, without actually knowing how to defend themselves. So that goes back to the idea that women had basic combat training but didn't have that higher-level infantry training. So the first group of women were put out there without any real infantry skills, and they just kind of mimicked what the men were doing. Incredibly dangerous. But one of the other things that kind of got women caught up in danger is that there was this rule that because women weren't officially in combat, they couldn't stay out on these missions for as long as the men could. So they would be out there for a short period of time, and then they'd have to be driven back to a forward operating base, stay there for, you know, a couple of nights, and then be driven back out to the combat mission. So because they couldn't stay out there for an incredibly long time, they were exposed to even more danger driving back and forth from, you know, where the mission was being handled to the FOB and then back again. So, of course, whenever you're driven around, you're exposed to guerrilla warfare because, as we know, the front lines are everywhere. You're exposed to IED. You're exposed to all kinds of things. And it was women who were getting exposed to that more than men because of that rule.
Okay, so they were the ones actually out there in the open because they were going from place to place more often, sure.
Exactly. Yep, they were traveling more. So that, you know, exposed them to more danger.
Eileen, you provide a good history in here and show that as far back as the Revolutionary War, women were taking part in army activities, although obviously less official the further back in time you go. You did
right.
just mention in passing Team Lioness, which is a really important mm-hmm. Step here. What was that?
So Team Lioness was started in 2003, and that was really the military's first foray at female engagement. They weren't officially called female engagement teams back then. I focus in this book on the Battle of El Ramadi. That was one of the bloodiest battles in Iraq. And a lot of people don't know that women were actually there. So at Camp Junction City, There were several combat units there, and they were breaching cultural barriers by sending infantry men out to try to frisk women. You know, there are all kinds of strict Muslim edicts that say that men who aren't related to a woman, men who don't know a particular woman, aren't supposed to touch her, aren't supposed to have these really close conversations with her. And so the military at first was kind of pushing their way into these villages and doing it anyway. And they realized that by breaching these cultural barriers, they were kind of potentially creating enemy villages. And so they stopped doing that. And they figured, okay, let's send women. We have women at Camp Junction City who are incredibly capable. Let's start sending them out in groups of 2 to 3 attached to these infantry units and have them talk to the women, the Iraqi women, have them frisk Iraqi women. And that's really the beginnings of female engagement.
So did Team Lioness become essentially the template for what led to the FETs, the female engagement teams?
Exactly. They were the template. And they were, you know, as I was saying before, that first group of women who went out there without any training. And what the military eventually learned was, okay, we can't send these women out there without training. But they were the pioneers. They were the ones who started it all.
A couple seconds up to a break here, Eileen, but do the FET members actually have more duties than their male counterparts?
They did. So, you know, the first thing that distinguished them was obviously they could talk to the women, but then they also, you know, focused on a lot of nation-building skills that infantry units weren't really focusing as much on. So they were helping women get microloans to start businesses. They were holding all-female shuras. And this goes beyond Iraq. This is Iraq and Afghanistan, where they would register women to vote. They would sit down and listen to the needs of women and children. They would hold, you know, health seminars. Doctors would come and not only examine women, but their children, give them medical supplies. So they really were doing a lot of things that pushed progress forward because they were helping women economically. They were helping women socially in ways that men weren't.
Well, women in American uniform helping women overseas in Afghanistan is the subject of Eileen Rivers' book, Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. We'll talk about Sergeant Sheena Adams, Major Maria Rodriguez, and Captain Joanna Smoke. And we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Eileen Rivers, who is a longtime journalist, editor, and editorial board member at USA Today. Did a lot of war reporting on Iraq and Afghanistan, is herself an Army veteran. Served in Kuwait just after the first Gulf War. She's written a book about women in female engagement teams, FETs, working with the local women in Afghanistan. The book is called Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. You can join our conversation on the exchange by phone at 800-838-3760 with questions and comments. Send those by email instead to jx@jeffnet.org. So the female engagement teams ultimately become the military realizing there are more tools in the toolbox than just the weapons. It's the military and intelligence communities realizing a potential wealth of information and, for that matter, goodwill that can't be accessed by men.
That's right. And so, you know, I'll address those two aspects very differently. I'll address the second one first, which is that I think a lot of people, when they think of how to fight a war, how to push out the Taliban, how to push out terrorism, they're not really thinking about some of the skills that women brought to the table in the form of female engagement teams outside of those combat missions that were very diplomacy-driven. And so I mentioned microloans earlier. You know, the more economically stable a village is, the better they can fight against terrorism recruiting, for example. So a lot of what female engagement teams tried to do was economically empower women so that families could be more stable and then, by extension, villages could be more stable. And just, you know, personally, I think I'm not a military strategist, I'm a journalist, but, you know, I think that's often a very critical step and perspective that's missing when we sit down and talk about war strategy and how we're going to fight terrorism. I think that's a very critical skill. And then, you know, absolutely, you're right. Something that they brought to the table that, you know, men couldn't necessarily bring to the table was this ability to, you know, reach out to women and gather intelligence. And so, you know, a lot of what that first combat team that went out there with Team Lioness we were talking about earlier realized was that, you know, from over half the population were missing critical information. Terrorists observed that men stopped interrogating women and stopped frisking women, and they were therefore hiding information on Afghan women that military infantry units and intelligence units were missing. And so those were two huge components that female engagement teams definitely filled.
And is the FET playbook very specific, or are the women allowed and perhaps encouraged to improvise a bit?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think it, you know, sometimes the female engagement team mission would be very specific to certain areas. So, you know, there were some women, you know, something I really emphasize with Maria Rodriguez, and this certainly wasn't the only thing she did, but something that she focused really heavily on was training up female military police, for example. And that contrasted a little bit with what Joanna Smoke focused more heavily on, which was helping a woman named that I call in the book Jamila, who became this incredibly huge freedom fighter in Afghanistan. And she would say to Jamila, you know, just call me your chief of staff. Whatever it is that you need, that's what I'm here to facilitate. And Jamila was really focusing more on women's rights. She was focusing on registering females to vote. She was really focusing on female empowerment. And while it's very empowering for women to be able to work, and especially as police officers in a country like Afghanistan, Jamila's focus was more on helping everyday women, even those women who weren't working, which is the majority of the population in certain rural areas, especially in Afghanistan.
Jamila Abbas is an amazing story. Is that not her real name? Is that why you're saying you call her that?
Right. So, you know, she is, as I write about in the book, really targeted by local insurgents. So she runs a women's center, and that center has been bombed at least twice, one time when she was in it. So because she is such an ardent feminist, you know, insurgents are really gunning for her. I didn't want to put her in any more danger or any more trouble than she's already in. So I didn't feel comfortable using her real name. But she certainly herself doesn't shy away from, you know, being out there and strongly doing what she does.
Some of the stories about the things that happened to members of her family and the things she
exactly.
had to do to prevent worse things from happening, like having to actually hold the Quran up and say, okay, you're violating
right.
this book. Stop beating my kids.
Exactly. So there were, you know, terrorists, in this case, the Mujahideen, which, you know, is there are tons of terrorist factions in Afghanistan. We focus on the Taliban, but that are vying for power. And there are even certain areas where, you know, I interviewed the police chief in Zabul, and he said that there are areas not just that we don't send women, that we don't send anybody who's a police officer because they're so dangerous and because there are so many terrorist factions fighting for power. But yes, the Mujahideen did come after her husband. They ended up beheading her husband in front of her and her children. And then they came back to come after one of her sons. And she, you know, just found this inner strength to confront them with the Quran. And she said, you know, you claim to be super religious, but what you're doing doesn't follow the edicts of this holy book. And she confronted them with it. And for whatever reason, they decided to stop. They stopped threatening her son and going after her son. And she didn't let these attacks on her family, her husband, things that were done in front of her children, defeat her. She, in fact, became this, you know, incredibly powerful woman and this incredibly powerful freedom fighter for other women. Just an amazing story.
Eileen Rivers is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book about American women serving in Afghanistan is called Beyond the Call. Some of the incidents that you describe in the book with Jamila happened before the American invasion. Did life improve
right.
at least a little for women afterward?
That's a great question. I think in many ways it did. The female engagement teams were certainly there to try to help empower women and help them improve their lives. And then in other ways, as you know, live in an area that's being where there's a war going on, where your family is in danger, where you are in danger, sometimes the female engagement teams and the U.S. military in general felt like they weren't necessarily making as much progress as they would have wanted to. I mean, a lot of women that I interviewed said it, you know, it felt like, you know, three steps forward and two steps back in terms of progress they were making. You know, they would land on the ground. They'd try to train women as much as they could. They'd try to help women as much as they could. They'd try to, you know, build relationships with females in local villages. And they often felt like as soon as they started getting a foothold, their units would have to leave. And in fact, that's something that Joanna Smoke, who's now Joanna Hip, told me, is that, you know, she felt like she wasn't ready to leave, her commanders weren't ready to leave, and yet, you know, she had to leave. And she felt like there was so much more that could have been done and that the unit just didn't do justice. And so, you know, she ends up training another woman to come along, and in the meantime, while the new FET leader is trying to be trained, there are things that end up falling behind. There are women that end up quitting being, you know, female police officers in Afghanistan because they're frustrated. There are schools that they try to improve that either get attacked or the electrical systems break down. And by the time the next FET leader is you know, trained and ready to go, it's almost like starting all over again. So did the women's lives improve? And in some ways, they did. In some ways, there was newfound freedom. In some ways, they got microloans so they could be economically empowered. But in so many other ways, progress was so difficult that it was hard in many cases to make what I think a lot of FET team members would have wanted to be huge inroads.
And, you know, of course, under the true fundamentalist hardliners, a woman in Afghanistan is going to spend most of her time indoors. She will not have a job. She will not have an education. And when she does go outdoors, it's got to be with a male family member, even if it's somebody much younger than her, because she's not supposed to go out alone. There's an interesting twist you tell us about, though, Eileen, about the fact that some women took comfort in wearing burqas in Afghanistan.
Right, because, and you know, interesting twist is right. It's almost like this cloak of oppression ended up being, while it was oppressive, simultaneously a cloak of empowerment because, you know, at least it hid them. I interviewed a woman from Oxfam who spent time with a family in Afghanistan, and she said that, you know, often women felt safer because, you know, there were terrorist organizations that were attacking women on the streets, that were raping women on the streets. And at least if their bodies were fully covered, they could feel almost invisible, which is a horribly sad thing to think about, that you are restricted from leaving your home, that when you do leave your home, it has to be with a male family member. And then even if you can leave your home with a male family member, your first instinct is to try to be invisible because it's that dangerous. And this was a woman from Europe who was, you know, living with the family to work through Oxfam. And she said that even she felt in these really rural areas, like, if I'm covered up, at least I won't be attacked like some woman I heard about being attacked and raped, you know, not too long ago right there on the street. So it's very hard for women to feel empowered, and yet there are stories like Jamila, who is an incredibly empowered woman.
Yeah, truly. She's an amazing woman. Eileen Rivers is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange from USA Today. She's the author of the book Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. This is a conversation you're welcome to join with your questions and comments about the American efforts in Afghanistan, particularly focused on women. 800-838-3760 by phone, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So let's meet the three women a little more extensively here. Sheena Adams, Sergeant Sheena Adams, why did she join the Marines?
I think, you know, she talks about when she was a kid, she always wanted to be a combat fighter. And so I think, you know, she joined the Marines twice. She was in once, going in with this goal of being a combat fighter, got a little bit you know, bored or maybe wanted to try something else, left, and then came back again. But, you know, she's got, you know, one of those unique stories. Maybe it's not quite so unique. Maybe we just don't hear from women who have this story because we don't expect them to. But for me, it was unique. I'd never heard a woman, even in my time in the military, talk about, you know, so passionately as she did, wanting to be in combat, wanting to be in infantry. That was always her dream and her goal since she was a little kid. And so that's why she joined. She ended up becoming a helicopter mechanic, which she said wasn't a job that she was thrilled about. So when she saw the opportunity to join the FET, she went for it in a big way.
So when she joined the FET, it sounds like some of the male soldiers were, I don't know, could you call it hazing? It seems like it's sort of in that realm.
Yeah, she certainly describes one experience that sounds a lot like that. So she, you know, her and her set team were with a FOB that was in an incredibly rural area of a southern province in Afghanistan. You know, and she said the first day there, they took her on this ruck march that she felt like was a bit of a test. And she said that she told her women, you know, keep up. Whatever you do, don't start crying. Stay in step because they're expecting us to fall behind. So there was this sort of extra pressure she was putting on herself to try to prove that as a woman, they could all do it. And she said she certainly felt like they were taking, you know, her and her group through their paces to see if they could hang and they could handle it. And they handled it.
Well, it sounds like a real balancing act, too, because the women in the FETs, the female engagement teams, have to be tough as nails as soldiers, but also human with people.
Right. And so that was a real kind of tough balancing act, because on the one hand, you're absolutely right. They have to go into these combat missions and do the same thing the men are doing. But then they're also trying to build these relationships with women. And at the same time, you know, Joanna talked about having to report on and collect intelligence on the same women she was trying to help. And she said to her that there was always a sort of internal struggle. It's like on the one hand, she knew that what she was doing and what she was collecting was important, but she also felt like there was a bit of, I don't know, kind of deception maybe. I don't know if that's too strong of a word, but definitely this balancing act between, you know, I want to be friendly with these women, I want to help these women, but at the same time, I also have this mission of, you know, collecting intelligence on these women and knowing that they could give me information that could lead, you know, U.S. troops to infantry units, to IED cells, to weapons caches, and that sort of thing.
And the women often knew these kinds of things?
Well, they could definitely provide what are called, you know, atmospherics, and provide information that could give women clues. So, you know, Joanna talks about collecting information. Well, first of all, some of the women, you know, going back to that frisking thing, where you could frisk a woman and find on her a cell phone SIM card or find on her maps or, you know, written plans. So that was definitely the case. But also in collecting atmospherics, just intelligence that you collect by sitting down and listening and observing what's happening around you, or, you know, talking to women about, have you heard anything about what's happening at the local market? Do you know why people aren't there today? Have you heard that there are any plans going on, you know, for insurgent groups to come and attack? The line of questioning wasn't necessarily always that direct, but, you know, if a woman says, I'm avoiding going to the market on this particular day, and you inquire a little more deeply as to why, that can certainly give you clues about whether there's something being planned or potentially something happening. That's not always going to pan out, but those are certainly the kinds of things you would ask about and listen for.
Sheena Adams, you report in the book, was in an IED explosion. Was she ultimately mm-hmm. okay?
She reported getting a traumatic brain injury from that. She also got, you know, a combat action ribbon from that that fight. She also ultimately ended up getting invited to State of the Union. So in many ways, she kind of became this poster child for, you know, female engagement team courage and success. And then sort of ironically, being in the female engagement team was what kind of ended her career in the Marines. The second time around.
How so?
Well, you know, she's also an example of what we call the Kevlar ceiling in the military. If you're enlisted, and the brass ceiling, if you're an officer, similar to what women call in the civilian world, the glass ceiling, which is that, you know, in many instances, you're only going to get promoted so far because there's this kind of boys network. And in the military, for female engagement team members, that kind of same pattern happened because, you know, women who were on female engagement teams in many instances stopped doing their regular job. So when they came back for, you know, to go before a promotions board, their evaluation couldn't include what the evaluations of other people they were competing against included, which was how did they do in the last year on their job? Well, if you're away on a FET mission, you're not doing your job. So you can't be evaluated on that. You're doing a combat job. You're doing a combat mission. And then also when she got back, her and her husband decided to start a family. So she ended up, you know, getting pregnant. She was out of the office on maternity leave, and her packet that was supposed to go before the promotions board was kind of lost. And so that became a problem. And she definitely wanted to make clear that there were many people who went to bat for her, but there were all these kind of circumstances that a lot of women faced when they became female engagement team members that kind of counted against her. And there was also somebody in her chain of command, she said, that said to her when she was fighting to become a female engagement team member that this is going to be sort of the death of your career, because you're going to go over there, you're going to be in combat, and you're not going to be doing your job, and that's going to, you know, be trouble for you. And that definitely ended up being the case. It sort of got her in this catch-22 situation where she was serving her country in really dangerous circumstances, and then kind of didn't get rewarded for it in a way that would have pushed her career forward.
Do the FETs still exist?
They do.
Mm-hmm. And so they managed to find a way to make them actually part of the job in terms of promotions?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's different now because women now can be in those combat roles. So, you know, when they go out there and they perform all these combat duties, that counts now in a way that didn't before, unfortunately. So these women kind of pave the way for the benefits that other women are reaping now.
All right. As we mentioned, the first women graduated from infantry basic training just last year in 2017. So these women predate that in their time in Afghanistan. We're talking to Eileen Rivers about her book, Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with her. And if you'd like to join us by phone and email, you are welcome when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Eileen Rivers, who is an editor and editorial board member at USA Today, a longtime journalist, covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, actually spent some time in the Army herself, serving in Kuwait just after the first Gulf War. She's written about other women in the service using guns, hearts, minds to do their jobs in Afghanistan, helping to make contact with Afghan women through female engagement teams, or FETs. The book is called Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines in Afghanistan. You're welcome to join our conversation on the exchange with your questions and comments. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about Army Major Maria Rodriguez, Major now. We haven't talked about her very much so far, and it sounds like she's a very patient person, and she endured a lot of slights and rudeness in her job.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. She was an incredibly patient woman, as all these women are, and had to sort of constantly exercise that patience and perseverance as they were doing these female engagement team jobs. But yeah, she really had to wait for a long time for those female police officers to warm up to her. So, you know, when I mentioned Maria Rodriguez earlier, I mentioned that one of the big things that she focused on was training Afghan female police so that they could, you know, take over when American female engagement teams left Afghanistan. And so she was really trying to build, first she was trying to find where, you know, Afghan female police were, on this base where the provincial governor was. And she, you know, was in a room every Sunday for this, you know, weekly meeting with the provincial governor, with a couple of his, officers, with her commanding officer. And she was the only female in the room. She was not allowed to speak. As the only female in the room, the only way she could really have a voice was writing these little notes to her commander. She would scoot over on the couch. They kind of sat her away from everybody else, hand him the note, and if there was a moment in the conversation where he could bring up whatever she was inquiring about, he would try to bring it up. If there wasn't, he wouldn't. So she went through several weeks of that, one exercise in patience, to try just to find out where these women were. And then when she finally found them and met them, they were really afraid to talk to her. These were women that were kind of sequestered in a room by themselves. They were supposed to be getting training as female police officers. They weren't. They really weren't working all day. And so when she was sent up there, they kind of thought, well, who's this, you know, American female officer we've never seen before suddenly coming up here to talk to us when we've been ignored all this time? She later found out that the women thought that she was there to report on them to the provincial governor, which is kind of understandable. If you've been ignored all this time and then suddenly the provincial governor is sending somebody up to see you, you might be suspicious. So it took another couple of weeks for them just to warm up to her. And I love the story about how they finally did. It was through photos of their children. So one of Maria Rodriguez's team members said, "Do you have kids?" And they suddenly realized that they had this bond in common, that, you know, there were women on each side who had children, who missed their children, who understood what it was like to try to serve and be far away from your kids. And that became the bonding moment that kind of broke the ice.
How successful have the Afghan women police been? I'm just curious about whether they're restricted in their duties, because let's face it, they're still belonging to group of people in a society that does not really value women in the workplace.
Right. So it's, you know, there's this sort of strange contradiction in Afghanistan. On the one hand, men who are very well educated realize that they need women and they need the special skill set that women provide, which is being able to frisk other women. And so, you know, when I interviewed the Zabul police chief, he said that, you know, yeah, I asked him a similar question. How is it that women are faring in a country where people don't want women to work? And he said, you know, it's men in these incredibly rural areas. It's insurgents who don't want women to work. What we have to do is educate those men. That's the barrier to really getting women the rights that they need, is education. And so the police chiefs definitely recognize that female police officers are necessary. What a lot of women have to fight in these really rural areas are their male family members who don't want them to work, are male members of the community who don't want them to work, and who call the police headquarters with death threats, who start rumors that women are being treated as prostitutes within these police departments, and who, you know, pressure these women so much with threats and with other sort of emotionally abusive and sometimes physically abusive treatment that they cause these women to quit. So it's almost like this need for education has to keep pace with, you know, all of these attacks on women to the extent that they kind of educate men out of thinking that that's okay. And that's certainly a struggle.
So what did the three women you profile in the book tell you about their feelings about the things they were trying to get instituted, like women police officers in Afghan society, and knowing that, you know, when the FET was gone, that the two steps backward would probably be taken?
Right. I mean, it was a lot of frustration. In many ways, that reflected outside of the FET, just a larger frustration that I think a lot of men were also feeling with the military mission on the ground in Afghanistan, that it's really hard to make progress. It's not just women who deal with issues of training and lack of it and lack of education. It's, you know, men in the military and in the, you know, police force in Afghanistan who are dealing with the same issues. A lot of men aren't very well trained. A lot of the men aren't very well educated. I mean, education obviously is worse for women because there's this concerted effort to keep them from being educated. But, you know, the education that's often there for men and the training that's there for men is lacking. So I think, you know, all troops on the ground certainly felt that. I think it was probably felt perhaps a little bit more by female engagement teams because they were really dealing with a segment of the population that was even less, you know, trained and less educated. But, you know, I don't think that feeling is unique just to female engagement teams.
Yeah, that is true there. Okay. There are pictures in the book, I should point out. And when we come to talk about Army Captain Joanna Smoke, there are more pictures of her in the book than the others. Was she more successful than the others, or just have the opportunity to get some more pictures taken?
No, I think she definitely had the opportunity to get more pictures taken. And when I was looking for pictures from the women, she certainly sent me a lot of her own photos that she took when she was there. And I think it also reflects a lot of what was unique about her mission compared to what the focus was for some of the other women. A lot of those photos from her are of women registering to vote. And so you see women with burqas on that are holding that thumbs up, and you see that their thumbs are inked. So they're, you know, registering to vote or voting. And she, and like I said, was working with Jamila to get a lot of women to do that for the very first time. These are some women who were like in their 40s who had never registered to vote and who were initially very afraid to. And so I think that there was a lot of victory there in that. And that certainly reflected how her mission differentiated at least a little bit.
Some of the things that they had to do, though, I mean, we're talking about trying to work in an alien culture. These generally didn't speak the language themselves, but they had Pashto interpreters. Is that right?
Correct. They had interpreters. Yep, Dari and Pashto.
All right. So just trying to navigate through this culture, through this through the language barrier, and then just the things they had to do that you don't generally do in America. There's a picture of Joanna Smoke listening for the breath of a baby who has been sedated by its mother with opium.
Yeah, that was something that was really hard to take, both for her and when I heard it, for me as well. But something that women, some women in very rural areas who have a lot of kids do is, you know, try to sedate their children to calm them down. And Joanna Smoke sort of described that as like being a babysitter for some women because they had so many kids and they were just trying their best to kind of handle and manage everything. And so, yeah, in that photo, she kind of was afraid that this child was not breathing. And it was, you know, the child was breathing. It was just so sedated that it was hard to tell.
Yeah, was breathing. That's the important part.
Correct.
So
right.
Joanna Smoke, you mentioned she's Joanna Hip now, was put in a WITA study and wasn't particularly appreciative. What was that?
Right. So women in the Army, this was a study that was done after the Pentagon initially, you know, the Pentagon kind of went in fits and starts saying we're going to open these roles to women. And they sort of started opening slightly more roles and slightly more roles over time. And about the beginning of that time period, Joanna was supposed to go to special operations. She had put in her application. She had, you know, essentially been approved. She was ready to go. And instead of being able to do that, she was pulled into this WITA, Women in the Army study, where they wanted to put women, you know, in all-male units to see how that could affect readiness for male combat soldiers. And she thought, you know, I've already done this. Why didn't they come to me after I served time in Iraq? She went to Afghanistan after she'd been in Iraq the year before. Wow. So she thought it was like, you know, too little, too late, and was very frustrated at the prospect.
So what did these women tell you about not only their own daily lives, but how they kept themselves and team members motivated on tough days? This is, you know, clearly pushing our boulder up a hill kind of stuff they were doing in Afghanistan.
Right. I mean, you know, one thing that these women certainly had, as I said earlier, was perseverance. You know, and you're right. It was definitely hard quite frequently to stay motivated because it felt like in some instances you weren't necessarily making progress. I think both of Maria Rodriguez most immediately and also of Joanna, and that the story that Maria told me after that first time they visited with these female police officers, and some of her women were saying, you know, why are we even doing this? These women don't seem like they want help. They don't really want to talk to us. There are other women who could be benefiting from what we have to offer. And, you know, one thing she said was it takes patience. And that was something that her commanding officer had said to her. And this kind of gets back to, you know, how these missions are very reflective of one another, the FET mission and the overall combat mission. Because she said that, you know, something that stuck in her mind from her commanding officer was, you know, to make progress in this country, it takes tons of patience. Trust me, he said to her, there are things that you have been asking for that, you know, I have been asking for things for probably twice as long and still haven't gotten. And she said that just sort of reflecting on that mantra for herself and telling that mantra to her female engagement team kind of kept them motivated. And, you know, often people would rely on family. One of the reasons that Joanna wanted to go to special operations was because her father had done the same thing in Vietnam, and her father was definitely her hero, and she wanted to do the same thing, and she often called her dad in moments when she was feeling kind of low to try to figure out, how do I motivate, you know, my troops? How do I motivate my FET team to make them want to keep going? Because, you know, it's definitely hard in general, And it's certainly hard as a member of a Fed to keep pushing when, you know, you're getting a lot of pushback just being in country overall, and then sometimes you're getting pushback from your unit as well. And so I think those were certainly two different examples of staying motivated.
So definitely some downside to the women from even serving in the FET program. But you also relate that Sheena Adams took some steps to attempt to save it. What sort of threat faced the FETs?
Right. So, you know, the U.S. was moving out of Afghanistan. And so, you know, the idea was we are kind of you know, playing down the combat mission at this point, and perhaps we don't need female engagement teams anymore. So they were working on phasing them out at one point. And Sheena Adams was thinking, well, how can we keep these teams going in other countries where the terrorist threat is high, but we don't necessarily have a military presence? We can drop female engagement teams into those countries in some sub-Saharan African countries, for example, where there definitely are terrorist groups like Boko Haram that are threatening women in very similar ways. I mean, the protocol for terrorist groups is not all that different when you look at what's happening in the Middle East and what's happening in some sub-Saharan African countries. You know, they're definitely trying to oppress women and keep them from being educated. They are trying to terrorize women and children. They are, in some instances, abducting women and children. And so she thought, how can we take this protocol and use it in other countries? She wasn't necessarily successful at that. She was trying to definitely push that. But she certainly thought that was a way to save the program. And so the program ultimately did kind of phase out. And then they realized, well, wait a minute, we need these women. And so there were troops on the ground who were asking for female engagement team women. And then they ramped the program back up again.
So just a couple seconds before we have to part here, Eileen, are the women all convinced of the value of what they did? Are they proud of what they did?
Oh, absolutely. They're proud, and they're also very humble about what they did. I mean, one thing that struck me over and over again was these women said, you know, we were called to do missions, and we did them. We did a lot of the same things that men did, but the men were certainly heroic and making all kinds of efforts. And we were, in instances where we were, you know, joining them on combat missions, certainly following their lead. They definitely downplayed a lot of the work that they did and said, you know, we weren't doing anything more than the men were doing. The difference in my mind is that they weren't getting recognized for it. And my goal with this book was to try to get them the recognition for what they were doing that Americans certainly didn't know about.
Well, you have done that. It's called Beyond the Call, Three Women on the Front Lines at Afghanistan, the work of Eileen Rivers. Thank you so much for joining us today.